State v. Dwight Nelson. May we please have appearances? Welcome, counsel. Ms. Hubbard.
May I please record? Before I begin, I'd like to reserve a few minutes for rebuttal, if necessary. In the instant case, an ATF officer contacted someone at the New Jersey State Police Department to convey a tip that someone would be riding between New York City and Philadelphia with marijuana. The only information contained in the tip was the model and plate number of the car and the race and gender of the driver. Not only was the identity of the purported tipster unknown, but the identity of the ATF officer who was conveying this tip was unknown. But the police went out and found a car based on this tip that contained only easy-to-know facts. Now, to justify the stop of that driver, the police rely on the fact that they say Mr. Nelson committed two traffic violations, falling too closely behind a car in front of him and failing to maintain a lane when the tire went over into the shoulder. Although the police stopped Mr. Nelson on the turnpike for these motor vehicle infractions, the police actions from the commencement of the detention were clearly based on the unsubstantiated tip, and the police treated this entire encounter not as a traffic stop, but as a drug investigation, holding Mr. Nelson for no less than 75 minutes. In a case where the police were only writing two simple traffic tickets, they first had Mr. Nelson on the side of the road for 38 minutes, and after detaining him for the better part of an hour, when he failed to give them consent to search his car, they brought a dog to the scene. Now, that extended the stop by another 37 minutes. The law division judge acknowledged that the dog sniff, quote, extended the length of the time of the initial motor vehicle stop and expanded the scope of the search beyond the limits of the motor vehicle stop, close quote. The trial court, however, considered the extension justified because of a legal conclusion that there was reasonable suspicion. But contrary to the trial court's holding, the officer's observations of entirely innocent and innocuous things did not develop reasonable suspicion to justify the extension of the traffic stop to engage in this dog sniff. Now, what factors did they rely on to claim reasonable suspicion? That somehow it was strange that a man of African descent was nervous and perspiring as three state troopers pulled him out of a car and had him stand on the side of a highway, the turnpike, as they questioned him in the rain about his itinerary and past experiences in the criminal justice system, or that he had a prior from 9 years earlier for possession of marijuana, that he didn't know the exact street address of family members he was visiting on that day, or that he had three single air fresheners in an entire SUV vehicle, or that he didn't have personal belongings in the passenger compartment of an SUV, even though the record makes no mention of anything to suggest that this was going to be an overnight trip and that he would need personal items for a trip between two cities that are 2 hours or 110 miles apart. These observations didn't amount to reasonable suspicion or corroborate the anonymous tip. Now, the appellate division, after finding that the tip did not provide reasonable suspicion, relied on the initial stop, the traffic stop, saying that because, and citing Dunbar, saying once the propriety of the stop is established, law enforcement agents do not need a particularized reasonable suspicion to conduct a sniff. And they, as I said, were citing Dunbar there. The appellate division's determination, however, that the existence of the motor vehicle infractions justified the extension of the traffic stop to conduct the sniff was improper because the sniff did not simply take place during the traffic stop. Instead, the sniff improperly extended the detention by no less than 37 minutes. Such an extension is not countenanced by the United States Supreme Court's holding in Rodriguez or by this court's holding in Dunbar. There's no place for the engrafting of a grace period to allow the police who have completed or should have completed a traffic stop to extend the stop to conduct a dog sniff. The evidence in the case should have been suppressed.
You're done with your opening statement. Can you clarify one thing? You just told us that the tip included the plate number. And the testimony is that the registration number was conveyed, and yet it was only a six-digit number. Are we talking about the plate, or are we talking about the numbers that appear on a registration? I realize we're talking about Florida. Go ahead.
It's not entirely clear. The way I read it, I would say the plate number, but it's not entirely clear from the record which number they're referring to.
So the 462 PPR, do we know from the record, does that match the plate?
I believe so.
In which case it would have been observable from anybody outside looking at the car.
I cannot be sure, but in all candor, I believe so based on other things in the testimony. We're not contesting that the tip included the very type of easy-to-know information that allows you to identify someone.
No,
this type of car.
The reason I'm asking is, if indeed the tip had conveyed that very long number that appears on the New Jersey registration document, that would be telling. But that, even though it's called that in the record, and maybe the state can clear this up, it sounds like we're talking about the plate and not the VIN number / registration number?
That is what it appears to be.
Okay.
They find the car within 13 minutes, and they describe noticing that it's a black male driving and it's the right make, and it seems to be
also the right correct license plate number to what the tip was given.
I'm sorry.
The car also had the correct license plate number with the relationship to the tip I was given. It was just a black Infiniti, like a million of them on the road. It also had the license plate number that was given.
Yes, that's what I was indicating, the plate number.
You said these were all easy to know details. And
yes.
Certainly if an observer, let's say, in Philadelphia could spot the car, could write down the license plate. If somebody who had some reason to give a false tip, the Infiniti, et cetera. But is it easy to know that the car will be traveling on a particular road at a particular time?
You know.
And if so, why is that easy to know?
Well, I think it's important to know what the road is, the turnpike.
Well, it's
right?
You know, obviously and it so is an it's a road that lots of people, but there are also millions of people who are not on the turnpike at this moment, as hard as that is to even believe, but to know that someone is going to be on the New Jersey Turnpike northbound in a particular time frame, that implies some level of knowledge, does it not?
No, for the following reason, or not the type of knowledge that's not hard to know and alleviates the concerns we have when these type of tips are given. What we have is the officer telling us that he receives the tip at 6:30, they find the car at 6:43. So we don't have a situation that we have in some other cases, right, where we have someone saying, hey, tomorrow, or even this afternoon, at 4:30, this person is going to be leaving their apartment. And the police go, and they look, and they see at 4:30, like in Bergemeyer, that person comes out with a laundry bag, and they're leaving their apartment. We don't have that. So we actually have a situation where someone who is riding down the road can see the car there. It's the turnpike, and they can call right then. We only have 13 minutes between when the police say they received the tip and when they see the car. So no, it doesn't provide the type of predictive information that might indicate that there's a basis of knowledge from the tips.
How about knowing where they're going? I mean, because the turnpike goes a long ways, because we're talking about 95, that's going all the way down to Florida.
Down to the Keys.
So the tip said Philadelphia. Right?
Which is the next big city, and we would note that. So the next big city from New York to Philadelphia, I'm sorry, the next big city after New York would be Philadelphia, so that is not.
There's no direct exit from the turnpike to Philadelphia, is there?
I'm sorry?
There's no direct exit from the turnpike to Philadelphia.
Well,
you would have to get off at Route 70, go down to the Benjamin Franklin Bridge, or get off at 130 and go to Walt Whitman Bridge.
Actually, I believe the turnpike turns into 95, and then 95 you can go through
below,
Center City.
Below Philadelphia. Well,
I'm from that area. So
yes, yeah, so
95
am I.
Turns into
just
Center
so
City.
Am I.
Yeah. Yes, you are. Right?
And I've been on the turnpike myself.
You're both
hearing.
Wrong.
We
You're
need
both
a hearing wrong. So you can both testify about the direction.
But you can go 95 and then you can go into Center City.
I do agree, though, that this tip is more revealing than simply saying car is traveling southbound on the turnpike.
In the fact that it says going to Philadelphia?
Coming from New York, going to Philadelphia suggests some level of knowledge, more than traveling southbound would. You don't agree with that?
Perhaps. I will simply say where the car is located, the two big cities between where the car in, that the road connects New York and Philadelphia. That's where the car is found. So, you know,
some people actually go to Trenton on the turnpike and stop at other places.
The turnpike could stop any. Look, it's not just that it's in the direction of Philadelphia. The things past Philadelphia, the things before Philadelphia, and the person said Philadelphia. You know, pivoting off of what the Chief Justice said, you don't think that that's predictive or one of the great guesses of all time?
I don't think it's a particularly great guess. I think that those are two places. When you pick the two largest cities that this road would connect in this area of the country.
But after after receiving the tip, they were able to stop this car within 13 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that indicative of the quality of the information that, that the state police got?
No, because that goes back to what Justice Patterson was speaking about, or when she raised the question, isn't this predictive? If we had a situation where someone said, at 6 o'clock, this car is going to be riding through, and it's 2 o'clock in the afternoon, the police see it because it indicates the person knows when the person is leaving New York, knows intimate details about their travel pattern, but because it is within 13 minutes, actually, I would argue it's the contrary. It's still a situation where someone who has seen the car at this moment can call in and say, hey, this person the person is now riding down the road. It's within the 13 minutes. It's not a situation where you're saying, because I know intimate detail, I can tell you this is going to happen this afternoon.
Well, didn't an independent magistrate at some point grant a search warrant on this?
There's a search warrant after
the stop.
Yes.
And
because of the dog sniff.
And the magistrate gave the warrant.
Yes, because of the dog sniff hit.
But you have to give information to the magistrate, independent magistrate, indicating why you want to make the why you want to do the search. And the magistrate found the evidence given by the police officers to be valid.
The evidence which the police officers had when they went to the magistrate, which was not the evidence the police officers had when they stopped the car or when they asked for the consent to search or when they bought the dog, or most importantly for our analysis, when they extended the traffic stop in order to bring the dog. So the fact that they then, after they get this hit during the extension of the traffic stop, can say, oh, and we had a sniff, a dog hit on the sniff.
Right.
I don't believe should play a role in the analysis about if the detention or, again, for our purposes more, the extension of the traffic stop in order to do the dog sniff is an appropriate action by the police.
How long can you hold someone, even if you have reasonable suspicion? At what point do you cross the threshold?
Well, there is not a case that says 43 minutes is too long or 68 minutes is too long. But what we do know is that the case law says the detention becomes unreasonable when essentially the police are acting unreasonably or in a way that exceeds what is needed to complete the mission.
How about 37 minutes?
Well, in this situation, the reason I would argue yes, and I mean, the reason that I've given the court the entire 75 minutes and then broken it down is because when the police first stop him, they are not conducting this stop in a way to expeditiously take care of the traffic warrants. The stop is being extended from the beginning as they are interrogating him about his prior contact with the criminal justice system and about his itinerary and these other things. And so the reality is, while the case law does allow for an investigation outside of the traffic stop, what it does not allow is for that investigation to extend the period of meeting the mission of the traffic stop. So we already know that for these two simple tickets, he's on the side of the highway standing in the rain for 38 minutes before we ever get to a consent. So there we have an extension. But then we have this second extension when he denies consent. And so what we have is really 75 minutes to issue two traffic stops. So we would argue that the 37 minutes, obviously because we are arguing that there is a reasonable suspicion under Rodriguez and Dunbar by themselves, is problematic. However, even if with the suggestion that there was reasonable suspicion, in this case we're talking about 75 minutes, they were not expeditiously taking care of these traffic tickets.
The truth of the matter is the first 38 minutes was not dealing with whether he was following too closely or whether or not his tire went over the fog line, right?
But here's the thing. It needed to be because it was not. And they clearly...
This is a helpful question for
you.
The answer to that is yes. The answer to that question is yes.
Yes. It was not about that.
So, I mean, so it's fair to say close to the hour and 15 minutes has to do with this so-called drug investigation.
Yes.
Okay.
Didn't the trial court... First of all, it was never disputed that the traffic laws were violated, correct? That was an admitted fact. That's not disputed.
There was concern raised before the trial court about the veracity of the officers. However, we never, in the appellate division nor here, there was a concession that there were these violations were issued.
Okay. No, that they occurred. That's not
disputed.
There's no challenge.
There is no indication. It is conceded that the judge found that they occurred, yes.
The judge also found that the officer's testimony was credible.
Yes.
And part of that testimony dealt with what the trial court found was the totality of circumstances. The appearance, conduct of the driver, nervous, sweating, the air fresheners based on knowledge and experience. The trial court considered all that, did they not?
That's a different analysis. The fact that he found the officer credible goes to his finding of fact.
No.
The fact that the totality of circumstances goes to the finding that there was reasonable suspicion, which was a different legal conclusion.
Hold on. He made those findings and found the officer credible in that regard as well, correct?
Made the fact findings?
Yes. Found the officer credible with regard to his statements about what he observed about the defendant.
Yes.
Okay. Now, under Dunbar, is that sufficient to extend the time of the traffic stop to wait for the dog to sniff the car?
Under Dunbar and Rodriguez, if there is a finding of reasonable suspicion, then the traffic stop can be extended for a reasonable period of time. The finding that there was reasonable suspicion, however, is not a fact finding. It is a legal conclusion. And so we...
No, I'm not. I'm just asking you. The trial court said the officer's credible. The totality is, here's what the officer... The stop's valid for a motor vehicle violation. Here are his observations, his testimony about knowledge and experience, and the trial court concluded that that was the reasonable suspicion. And that's why the traffic stop was permitted to be extended by the trial court in the appellate division.
That was the trial court's rationale
I'm
for
just
saying
to get
it was
to that. Okay.
Acceptable, yes.
Okay.
So I want to break it down and make sure we understand your position. Do you dispute that the officers had a lawful basis to stop the car based on the motor vehicle violation?
No.
And you've argued that the stop was unduly prolonged, so it comes down to whether there was reasonable suspicion to have done so. Is that fair?
Yes and no. I want to go back for just a minute and be clear on why I hesitated with the no. Because the record makes clear, I don't want to be less than accurate in what I read in the trial record, which is that there were concerns raised about the veracity of the officer, but the judge found the officer to be credible and found these as findings of fact. So then, based on those findings of fact, that there was the traffic violation and that it was a valid reason for the stop.
The question is, do you, on behalf of your client, dispute that the officers had a lawful basis for the motor vehicle stop? Are you challenging that, or are you not challenging that?
That's not before this court.
Okay. We can assume that's not in dispute. It's not being challenged. It's not before us. I can't have it both ways.
That's not before this court. I feel comfortable saying that's not before this court.
All right. So that takes us then.
I'm not trying to be quite. I have a record where that became an issue. We accept that that's what the judge found, and we're asking this court considering the we're accepting the judge's fact-finding, and
right.
So our challenge is based on that.
At this posture of the case, that's not an issue.
Correct.
The issue boils down to, from your presentation, whether there was reasonable suspicion to prolong the stop as you've seen it, correct?
Yes, and or if there was reasonable suspicion, as Justice Alvin pointed out, was the extension appropriate? So because it's just, as Alvin pointed out, you can have even reasonable suspicion, but there be an extension that is beyond the bounds of what is appropriate. But the initial question is, was there reasonable suspicion or not? And one of the reasons that's the initial question is because the law division judge found there was, and therefore that was the rationale for accepting the extension of the stop. The appellate division indicates the tip did not provide reasonable suspicion, but allows for the extension, and it seems as if there's an engrafting of a grace period without some justification for extending the stop. And so that's why we're before.
How many air fresheners is too much? Far too much.
Are you talking about in this case or just generally?
Perfectly lovely.
Let's start with this case. We'll move on.
I have no idea. The officer couldn't even tell us if they were big air fresheners or small
but
air fresheners.
Three. I mean, two three. And then a third one?
Yes.
What overpowering smell?
From three.
I mean, is it a factor along with everything else, totality of circumstances?
So I actually had the opportunity to look at some of the cases cited in the state's brief on why this air freshener presence should be a factor. It is clear that some of the federal cases have allowed it to be a factor. I think that when we are considering three air fresheners in an SUV vehicle, there's nothing unusual about that. But I would point out some of the cases where the federal courts, some of the cases the state cites, allowed for these air fresheners are a situation where the air freshener was in a rented car. So the officer said, wait a minute, it's strange for an air freshener to be in a rented car, and that played a role. Or in another case where they said the air fresheners were strangely placed. Now, I went back, I tried to go to the previous case. No one explains what strangely placed are. What we know is these three air fresheners, according to the record, are rear mirror and the driver's side console. So there's nothing strange about the placements of these air fresheners. And I would note, they're not even in the place where the officers apparently suspect the CDS is lodged. So they're where one would think air fresheners would be. There's nothing about these three air fresheners that should raise any suspicion.
The officer's experience was what he was relying upon to give way to the import of these air fresheners. Are you telling us that should be discounted entirely?
Yes, for the following reason. He didn't tell us what that experience was. How often had he had this experience with these air fresheners being used to hide drugs? And what type of air fresheners? How many? Is three air fresheners an unusual amount? Was that what he normally observed when people were trying to hide the smell of drugs? Were the air fresheners normally near the contraband that was supposed to be secreted by the scent deception? He never told us how often does this take place. He didn't. All he said was he announced, based on my experience in training, what was that experience in training? We don't have any of that information.
Did the drug tip say what type of drugs were being transported?
It did say marijuana. Okay. It did say marijuana. It did not say in what manner, but it did say marijuana.
But that is a drug that gives off a pretty potent smell, yeah?
It could give off a smell, yes. It could. But what we also have, again, is not the which is interesting. If the officer had said, I smelled marijuana when I got to the car, that would have been a different situation. But to say I smelled air fresheners, and we have three air fresheners, something that's very common in cars, and he doesn't provide for us any of this information of his training and experience about how these three air fresheners are supposed to mask the smell of a large amount of marijuana, by the way, when they're not next to the marijuana, but instead are in the front passenger
compartment. If they were next to marijuana, it would be a lot easier to find the marijuana, so you would put them somewhere else near the window, so when an officer came to the window, he'd smell air freshener. Don't you think that's more common sense than putting it on top of the marijuana that you're trying to hide?
No.
No? You put it right around the bag of marijuana?
You would try and get rid of the scent. But again, we don't know that because the officer didn't tell us. He didn't say where they normally put these air fresheners. He didn't tell us how these air fresheners would be masking the smell. He didn't tell us how often this was successful. He didn't tell us any of that. He simply announced, based on my training experience. But what was that?
Do we need a great deal of expertise and testimony to accept as reasonable that air fresheners can mask the smell of narcotics?
Well, I mean, I assume air fresheners can, unfortunately, don't always mask smells of things. They can conflict. But the fact that Well, you know what? Back up. This officer says that he has training and experience. And if we're just going to go off of, well, common sense, we've all had the experience where air freshener has been used and we still smell the thing that it's, we smell another scent.
But his point was a little bit different from that. I don't think he was testifying that it was effective or not effective. I think he was testifying about the purpose, in based on his prior investigation in drug cases, the purpose of it being used.
But he never told us what that prior experience was. He never said, this is the amount, this is how people, you know, these air fresheners, you use this type of air freshener, or this is how often I've seen this used, or that it was unusual, that it was it more likely or not, right? Was it a situation where, normally speaking, he encountered cars with air fresheners and there was no purpose to cover up?
So your position then is strike the air fresheners from any consideration.
This is what I will say. We understand that this court has indicated that innocent and innocuous facts can sometimes still contribute to reasonable suspicion. But we also know that the court is looking at the totality of the circumstances. In this situation, three air fresheners in an SUV, there's nothing unusual or out of the norm
with that 80 should have raised pounds the question. Of marijuana in it. 80 pounds.
Again, that's not something the officer knows. So how would that factor into his determination that three air fresheners raise a reasonable suspicion that there's drugs?
Well, you're saying that it's normal to have three, and I think the argument here is that there's 80 pounds of marijuana in the car. They have a tip that there's marijuana in the car, and they're acting on that by noticing that there's three air fresheners in there, perhaps masking the scent of the marijuana.
Again, this officer never told us that how many, when he says air fresheners are used, how many, how often does he run into this situation? Is it more likely that people he's stopping have air fresheners and don't have any drugs?
Ms. Hubbard, but wasn't the point of his testimony not that it was three, but that the smell was overpowering? That was the, I thought, suspicious aspect to this officer's observation.
I'm glad you raised that, because it's only on cross that we find out that this overpowering is really three regular-sized air fresheners. Mm-hmm. And then when he's questioned more about this overpowering, he talks about, or when he's asked to compare it, well, like when you just come from the car wash. Well, is that overpowering? The defense attorney is able to get out of him that this idea of overpowering could be the smell when you get out of the car wash. So that puts in context for us what overpowering is.
Okay.
So there wasn't, when we finally look at cross, what he's describing.
I'm just trying to get to the nub of what the officer was trying to emphasize in making this observation. He thought the smell was strong, correct?
But yes, but when he's pushed further on that, what do you mean by strong? He gives us a description of strong that is very normal when you come from the car wash.
Okay, I understand your position.
I think that that's important, because what we have here is a situation where, quite frankly, it's not a case where the police are looking to corroborate the tip. He's predetermined that any factor he finds is going to support this anonymous tip. Mm-hmm. So, smells like it just came from the car wash. That must be proof that you're dealing drugs. Every single factor is going to support this, not because it's reasonable, but because it's predetermined in his mind that the tip is
right. He's not saying proof. Nobody's holding the officer to a standard of proof. We're talking about reasonable suspicion. And he knows that we're dealing with marijuana, or that's what the tip would say, or he's potentially dealing with marijuana. So he sees that air freshener factor as relevant to the entire picture.
But the operative adjective is reasonable. And so that's why I point that out, because is it reasonable for him to think that these three air fresheners, the reason that what's happening is not reasonable.
Not standing, so this is a totality of the circumstances. So you got to throw everything into the mix. How about the laundry bags? He sees two large laundry bags.
So the
Go ahead.
So the laundry bags, this isn't a situation like we have in Burgermeier, right, where the tipster said the marijuana would be in the laundry bags. And when Mr. Nelson is asked about the laundry bags, he says, hey, I owned a store, which we actually know is true from the PSR, and those are shoes that, you know, I had to liquidate the assets of the store. And those are, so there was a perfectly normal reason, and had anybody checked it out, it would have made sense why he had those shoes. And if we're looking at the totality, or why those bags would have been there, if we're looking at the totality of the circumstances, I'll go through the rest of the factors that the state also talks about. So they talk about his nervousness. Now, you know, the state looks to cases, and this court has allowed for people to consider nervousness. But, for instance, in one of the cases where in Lund, where the court accepted nervousness as a factor that could go to the establishment of reasonable suspicion, the officer says, well, it seems strange. They were, you know, two people were in the car, was just issuing traffic citations, and they seemed so nervous. Now,
In the interest of time, I want to ask you to focus on a different factor.
Okay.
What is reasonable for the officer to think about the fact that the driver couldn't give the precise location of either the place that he had left or the place that he was heading to?
So, you know, I thought about that. I don't know most of my aunts or cousins' exact addresses, and I think most of us wouldn't. And he was able to tell where they were. I'm sorry.
Oh, go ahead.
He was able to say where he had been, but he didn't know their exact street address. And because they talk about, oh, the story changed, right? He didn't know the exact address. This thing about aunt and cousin. So
how specific was he about the address?
And the record does not make clear. There's a snippet of the police report in the PSR, but that's not part of the record. And I can tell you what the snippet said, but it's not part of the record. But so and the record doesn't tell us if he knew the block he was going to. He just said he didn't know the exact address. So unfortunately, we don't know. Again, the PSR makes an indication, but the record itself does not. Did I answer that? I don't know if the court would like me to. Again, that PSR snippet is not part of the record. But the officer did record in his police report.
Your point is a person can know where he or she is going and yet not know the address.
Yes. Yes.
How about not know who they're going to see?
Okay. Now I want to get to that. By the definition of an aunt. One's aunt.
Oh, wait a minute. Confused a friend with a relative.
I want an aunt. Well, I'm going to do both because they said he changed it up. So an aunt, by her very nature, is either the mother of one's cousins or the other aunt of one's cousins. So this idea that, as we questioned on the side of the road for 38 minutes, he tells us, I'm going to go see, I was seeing my aunt, and then they say, well, later he said my cousin. Well, first of all, those things aren't mutually exclusive, and one's visit to an aunt would oftentimes be a visit to a cousin. And the thing about the cousin in Philadelphia versus the friend in Philadelphia. Perhaps I am particularly fortunate, but my first friends outside of my house were my cousins, and they're still my best friends. And so again, these things are not mutually exclusive. And in addition to them not being mutually exclusive, so it's what we have is a situation where he's on the side of the road for 38 minutes, and they are concerned that he doesn't know the exact address of these individuals, but he knows where he's going. And he said, I'm going to go, you know, visit my cousin, and then they're concerned that somehow the cousin can't be the friend. And so there was the idea that we'll simply leave it at this was not a discrepancy that was a large discrepancy, and it's not clear it was a discrepancy at all to begin with.
So the issue is this may not be enough evidence to arrest a person, but all put together, is it reasonable to detain the person long enough so that a drug can sniff the car? If there's no positive reaction, the person goes on his way, and if not, the police were off trying to get a warrant.
Well, when we look at what the trial judge said was enough, and what the state says is enough. They included things like the fact that he had, that he committed the traffic violations, which had no nexus to any belief that he's involved in drug dealing or currying. They looked at the fact that he had a prior from 9 years earlier for possession. They looked at the fact that he was nervous. These are things, here's the situation we have. It is true that we can have, you know, I can stand here and say, but these are all innocuous and innocent, and the court can say, but we're allowed to take that into consideration. But no matter how we add up the following factors, 0 + 0 + 0 = 0. And so it's
are
not
really,
just...
Are these really zeros, though? Zeros. I mean, are you really taking the position that each of these has no bearing that to any finding of reasonable suspicion?
The fact that a man of African descent is standing on the side of the road for 38 minutes and is nervous in the rain, yeah, that's a zero.
There are a number of... My question is as to all of them. Are you really saying that none of these could ever contribute to a finding of reasonable suspicion?
Oh, they can contribute. They just didn't establish it here.
So it's not 0 + 0 = 0. It's there is something. There are indications here, and the question is whether they add up to a reasonable suspicion.
They did not, and in this situation, I'm explaining to the court. What I'm saying is, there are certain situations where some of these factors might help establish reasonable suspicion.
And some of them in case law have been found to be sufficient.
But and I've pointed out, for instance, the situations where this court has found, give an example, where nervousness would provide, not alone, but would provide some indicia, something to add to the equation, right? Or where the fact, the fact that the tipster is able to say something about the car and the driver might provide that. But what I've gone through or attempted to do is go through and explain why, in this case, when we look at what the police actually knew and the circumstances of the case, it doesn't provide that here.
I think you actually, you tell us, did you mean that these various features we've already discussed were each zeros? The fact that the car was traveling from New York to Philadelphia, the fact that there were no exact addresses given, the fact that there were three air fresheners in the officer's experience, each one is a zero in this case, as you view it.
Yes, but even if the court doesn't view it that way, I think when you look, even if the court wants to provide some weight to these factors, right?
It's not enough.
That's it. It's
Understood.
Not enough.
Understood. Is there anything you'd like to add? Briefly.
I don't think so. There is just one thing very quickly, and I won't go into it if the court may indicate it understands my argument, but there seemed to be not clarity on if we assert this is an anonymous tip, and it's clear that the appellate division treated it as an anonymous tip, and we just want to be clear that the fact that this was an ATF officer who's unknown and who's providing the tip from an unknown person does not somehow transfer this into some sort of reliable tip from a known individual. We just wanted to make that clear because there seemed to be some argument that somehow because this was purportedly from an ATF officer, it was no longer to be treated as an anonymous tip.
Thank you. Ms. Porter.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'd like to be really clear about the authority that derives from a traffic stop and what requires reasonable suspicion. And so I'd like to start, Chief Justice, with your question, is 37 minutes too long? And the reason the ACLU sought leave to participate as amicus in this matter is because the appellate division answered that question so mistakenly. So yes, 37 minutes is too long if it's based on a traffic stop alone. What we know Dunbar says is that the addition of any time beyond the completion of the traffic mission extends the stop. It's not an unreasonable prolongation. It's any prolongation that's prohibited by Dunbar.
Unless it's probable cause.
Excuse me?
Unless there's probable cause, and then it's not.
Exactly.
It can be extended beyond.
Exactly.
So the issue here is, was there probable cause or not? Otherwise, you're interpretation of Dunbar is not quite accurate.
So amicus asked this court to reaffirm that Dunbar, as you say, says what it says, which is that based on a traffic stop alone, a canine sniff or any other incidental check may not extend the traffic stop beyond the completion of the mission.
I don't think the state's even disputing
that. Exactly, exactly. And to your question, correct, without reasonable suspicion, not without probable cause, reasonable suspicion, not probable cause, can extend that stop. So just sort of doctrinally, what's really important to take as a starting point is that not what the appellate division said, but what Dunbar says is a canine sniff in this case is permissible, is constitutional, if either it's within the duration of the traffic stop mission or there's separate reasonable suspicion. And so to answer that question, I think it's really important to revisit what Ms. Hubbard pointed out as the three important timestamps in this case. And those timestamps are minute 0, minute 38, and minute 75. And what we know is that Mr. Nelson is pulled over at or around 6:43 p.m. That's what I'm calling minute 0. That starts the clock. We then know some amount of questioning, something happens for just over a half hour to get us to minute 38 when he refuses consent at 7:21 p.m. And then another 37 minutes transpire when the canine sniff occurs and the canine circles the car and gives that positive hit. And so although the question is, was that 37-minute prolongation constitutional? I actually think this court needs to look at that first 38 minutes instead, and it needs to answer two questions. First, by minute 38, had the officers developed reasonable suspicion? If they had, then under Dunbar, everything's good. If they hadn't, then we need suppression. But that's not the only question. The second question is, even assuming at minute 38 that they had reasonable suspicion, when did that reasonable suspicion ripen between minute 0 and minute 38?
Assume it was within the first 5 minutes.
Right.
Okay. What cases do you have that say that when you have reasonable suspicion to believe that drugs are contained in a car stopped on a major highway, an hour and 10 minutes is an unreasonable period to wait for a drug dog?
Assuming
there's the reasonable and articulable suspicion.
Right. And I don't actually think the parties have argued that if there is reasonable suspicion, or rather, I don't think defendant has argued, or the ACLU, frankly, that if there is reasonable suspicion, the 37 minutes it took for the canine sniff was unlawful. I think, Justice Albin, there are real questions about when a detention that's lawful, that's justified on the basis of reasonable suspicion, becomes a constructive arrest. I think the case law is not great on that for us. It says the number of hours. I encourage this court to find, given the coerciveness, that an arrest might happen before then.
Is that issue not before us?
I don't believe that's before you. And I don't think you need to answer the question of whether there was an arrest, whether there was probable cause for the arrest.
So does your position depend on whether we consider that first segment of time and add it to the second segment of time?
Not at all, and I'm sorry if I'm not clear. I'm urging this court to look at the first 38 minutes, to look at the moment when he refuses consent, and to say at that moment, right, when they call for the canine sniff, was there reasonable suspicion? And I'd like to briefly explain why I think there wasn't, because the tip is unreliable. But secondly, I'd like to explain why, even if there was at that point, we have to ask when the reasonable suspicion ripened. Because we know the parties concede, or Ms. Hubbard made clear it's not in dispute before this court, that he was lawfully pulled over on the Title 39s, right? So actually, if we look at the bookends of these three timestamps, we have agreement. We have agreement by the parties that he's lawfully pulled over on the Title 39s, that minute 0 is A-OK. We also have agreement that Dunbar doesn't allow the extension from minute 38 to minute 75. The Attorney General's office concedes that the traffic stop alone isn't enough for the canine sniff. So the question is all about reasonable suspicion and when it develops.
But what I'm trying to understand is, are you saying that if, for example, as was noted in the question, the reasonable suspicion was ripened, as it were, in the first 5 minutes,
right,
then the consent really is not the critical moment for determining the reasonableness of the extension?
Exactly. So the consent is the moment when the canine sniff, Judge Mega's findings, when the canine sniff begins, so to speak, right, that 37 minutes that it takes for the sniff. I actually don't care about those 37 minutes. What I care about is did reasonable suspicion ripen before then?
Well, because you do care, if I understood you correctly, because you're troubled by the appellate division analysis.
Exactly.
You want that corrected as a matter
I want
of
that law. Corrected, thank you. I care okay. about many things here. I want that corrected as a first principle. I think what the parties care about, to my left and my right, though, is whether or not reasonable suspicion developed. And I'm urging this court to say, if it did develop, when did it develop? Because, Justice Patterson, if it developed by minute 5, I think we're good and the conviction stands. But if it developed after the mission of the traffic stop was completed or should have been completed, Dunbar says there's a lapse in legal authority. And so that's sort of my second point. If I could start off with my first, which is that reasonable suspicion never developed at all, I would like not to spend time on talking about the zeros or whether they're zeros. I think the 8 factors, or at least 7 of them, are quite clearly innocent. And yet, of course, this court looks to a totality. I also think, though, that the Attorney General concedes that the 7 factors without the tip wouldn't amount to reasonable suspicion themselves. And so I want to focus on that tip. And I'd like to focus on why we're skeptical of anonymous tips to begin with. We're skeptical of them because we know they lack veracity, they lack reliability, and they lack a basis of knowledge. And with a normal civilian tip, of course, we can evaluate those 3 things. We know if Mr. Shalom leaves his house in the morning and his wife picks up the phone and calls the police and she says, my husband just left for work. I saw him put a gun and a kilo of cocaine in his bag and head to the office. We know how to evaluate her veracity.
It's good he stayed for this argument, so he can use it as an example.
I have to see him back at that office afterwards.
Good luck.
We know how to evaluate his veracity. We know, her veracity. We know how to evaluate the tipster, the wife's basis of knowledge. It's an entirely different story, though, if that's an anonymous tip. If the anonymous tipster calls the police and says, not I'm the wife and this is what I saw and this is how I would know, but rather Mr. Shalom is carrying a bag, it has a gun and a kilo of cocaine, and he's headed into the ACLU. That's not enough, and we wouldn't pretend that that's enough. That's because we don't know the basis of knowledge. We don't know the veracity. We don't know enough
to
assess
reliability.
Well,
that's the reason why this is a complete different analysis, right? Because we don't know reliability. So then we look at, well, how predictive it was.
Exactly.
And then we look, well, is there any corroboration in addition to the predictive element, right?
Exactly. And that's exactly what Florida v. J.L., Alabama v. White, and this court's opinion in Rodriguez say. We have to look and see if there's corroboration. And the question is, what kind of corroboration?
And well, also the predictiveness. Like, you use Florida versus J.L.
Right.
So that's apart from this, because there, anonymous tip that someone's on a street corner with a gun.
Right.
That's pretty. There's not much predictiveness there.
Exactly.
There's a person. This is a little bit different, though. The information that's given.
Exactly. So I think that's an important point. We would argue that driving south on the turnpike is not predictive in any way because it's so long a stretch that it's so static going south on the turnpike that it might effectively be the black man in the plaid shirt at the bus stop. The predictive piece is important, Justice Alvin, and that's, I think, where Alabama v. White is instructive. Because there, the tipster said, there, of course, the U.S. Supreme Court did find that there was reasonable suspicion, but they acknowledged that it's a close case and there was a strong dissent by Justice Stevens. But in that case, the predictive nature was a future action. The tipster said, Vanessa White is going to walk out of the apartment at approximately this time and she's going to go to this motel, and she hadn't yet left her apartment.
Was there an element of predictiveness in this tip in describing not just that the vehicle was traveling south, but that it was going from New York to Philadelphia?
Right. And so I think perhaps that's an invitation to move on to my second point, actually, because I think the only moderately helpful piece in this tip is the itinerary. I think Amicus would concede that saying New York to Philadelphia is not, I think it might have been you, Justice Alvin, is not just a lucky guess. Clearly the person knows or may have known that they were going from New York to Philadelphia. So I think we would concede that that's more helpful than...
Right, so this isn't someone who is driving next to the car, got on a cell phone, and called ATF. This is someone, it seems,
yes,
who knew where the person was going.
And so the question is, is that the kind of intimate knowledge, the hard-to-know information that the case law requires, right? Because especially in this day and age with social media, saying I'm driving on a Friday evening around 6:30 p.m. even from New York to Philadelphia is not hard to know. It's quite clear here that the tipster, the anonymous tipster, knew the itinerary.
So standing alone, maybe not. Maybe it's, but how about the other pieces? Because the transporting marijuana, air fresheners, two bundles in the back of the car. Go ahead.
What we're trying to do here is establish whether the anonymous tip has the indicia of reliability that's required to convert it effectively into a civilian tip.
Once you move from, this could be somebody just driving with malicious intent, calling the ATF or doesn't know or doesn't like the person for whatever reason. Right. Once you move from that to someone knows this person, mm-hmm. someone at least has been around the person or knows of someone who has conversed with that person. At that point, that adds to the veracity of the tip, does it not?
I think it does. What I would argue is it doesn't get us far enough. I don't think it substitutes for Mr. Shalom's wife. I don't think it's close even, actually, to Alabama v. White, when they're not only predicting when she leaves, but also, you know, sort of the exact route she takes. She makes several turns to get to the motel. And I think to go to your question, Justice Alabin, it's, I think it's helpful, but I think it's not intimate enough to be truly predictive.
Is it your argument that the police, the troopers, did not have a reason to stop the vehicle? Forget the anonymous tip. They saw motor vehicle violations. They stopped the vehicle.
We concede on this record.
So does it matter that they were following the vehicle because of an anonymous tip and saw the motor vehicle violations, or they had no anonymous tip and were following the vehicle?
I think that's an important question, actually.
I think so, too.
For pulling him over, it doesn't matter. I'm glad to see there's a scorecard.
Actually, that's two in a year.
if you'd like to ask another. I think it doesn't matter for pulling him over. And I think, again, the parties, including Amicus, here are quite clear.
So why do we care about the anonymous tip?
Because reasonable suspicion after its corroboration, such as it is, I think the Attorney General is saying reasonable suspicion develops because the tip is corroborated.
Does it bear as well on the totality of the circumstances?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
Does it as well bear on the totality of the circumstances?
So
I'm going to give it a 1 instead of a 0, but,
right.
but it factors in.
I would like to answer to those two questions. So just to finish off, I think that the important question that's raised is whether they can pull him over on the Title 39s. Of course they can. Good police work, though, would also say, yes, they can follow him until the Title 39s. They can also follow him all the way to Philadelphia, right? And so we're not saying, despite what the Attorney General suggests, that the police should just shrug their shoulders and let him go, let potential criminal activity go. There are all kinds of ways that police can do good police work here, including following him to Philadelphia, including calling the Pennsylvania state troopers. To your question, Chief, does it factor into the totality? I think what I'm trying to do here is to establish that the tip is not reliable, that there's never enough corroboration to convert it into a true civilian tip, and therefore we ask that you not consider it as part of the totality, because although the air freshener or the bags may have some non-zero amount of suspicion attached to them, and again, we don't concede that they do, but even if they did, that doesn't go to the reliability of the tipster. What we try to do with anonymous tips is say, is the tipster reliable? And so whether or not there's air freshener in the car doesn't go to whether or not the tipster was reliable.
It doesn't serve as corroboration. We know that the tips indicated marijuana.
Right.
The officer, obviously, based on his experience, knows that marijuana has a scent that people at times try to use an air freshener or three to mask. We have all that.
Right.
So isn't it corroborative when he observes bundles, marijuana, bulky, large volume, bulky amount, and then also notices these multiple air fresheners?
So I think to the extent the tip contains, you know, information that there's a large quantity of marijuana, the bags could potentially be corroborating. I think that's a stretch. I think also when I get to point two, there's some question about when they saw the bags. I think the two hanging from the rearview mirror and the whatever it is, Febreze-like thing in the door, I don't think corroborates at all.
Let me ask you to concisely give us your next argument. As amicus, you jump to it.
Yes. And so the second point is, even if this court finds with a totality, with these non-zeros, that there is reasonable suspicion, we submit that the record suggests that reasonable suspicion ripened after the mission of the traffic stop ended, which would mean the officers had a gap in legal authority. And the reason I say that is because I think we've established the sort of best part of the corroboration comes when Mr. Nelson acknowledges he's driving from New York to Philadelphia. And the record is clear that that doesn't happen immediately. What we know from this record is the officers pull him over lawfully on the Title 39s. They walk up to the driver's side of the car. He rolls down the window. They smell some amount of air freshener that may be overwhelming. They take him out of the car. They Mirandize him. And then they question him for some 30 minutes at the side of the turnpike in the rain, these three state troopers who are custodially interrogating. Some point in that questioning, we know he says the word Philly and we know he says the word New York. And I don't think the Attorney General can submit that he just sua sponte sort of exclaims Philadelphia when they walk up. So we know it takes some period of questioning before that tip is reliable. And so I submit to you that if reasonable suspicion ever ripens, it ripens at the moment that they confirm the itinerary. I think the record makes clear that they confirm the itinerary some period of time into questioning. And finally, I think the record makes quite clear that the mission, the traffic stop mission at that point, which we acknowledge, at least we pretend, was reasonable to begin with, but that has been completed or else it's been abandoned by them.
But it hadn't been. Where you're going with this? Yeah. He stopped lawfully. And they have the tip. You admit that they can pull him out to question him, or are you disputing that?
For officer safety, we know they can.
Okay. So let's say it takes them 10 minutes for him to say Philadelphia to New York. Or even 38 minutes. Are you going to say, oh, that was too long? At some point, the mission of questioning him was too prolonged?
That's what I'm saying on these facts, Justice Alvin. I'm not saying that as a general matter, 10 minutes for a traffic stop is too long. I'm not saying as a general matter, 38 minutes for a traffic stop is too long. I'm saying on these facts, the mission of the traffic stop, I think, was abandoned by the time they Mirandize him and are custodially interrogating him at the side of the turnpike. And the reason it's hard to know, actually, if it is hard to know, is to your helpful question to Ms. Hubbard earlier, which is, isn't this a pretextual traffic stop? Right? And so we know that actually, and in fact,
I don't think I asked that question.
I think you said,
but because everyone's conceding.
It was an excellent question.
Yeah, it was excellent.
Well, everyone's conceding.
And you asked it, it would have been great.
No one's questioning the police officers. Everyone has said, okay, we'll get over that. There's sufficient credible evidence to believe that following too closely.
And on the current jurisprudence, pretextual stops are permissible under Wren and O'Neill. What I'm saying is the reason the pretextual stop is important here is because it's hard to tease out exactly when that mission ended.
Well, what's your basis for saying this was a pretextual stop?
I think in this case, pretext doesn't mean unlawful. It's not contested that his left tire did move over the line and that he was too closely following, or at least Ms. Hubbard has said that's not before the court. So I'm not saying it's unlawful, but the detective got on the stand and said we wanted to pull him over for the anonymous tip. In fact, he says...
So yes, but they still need an objectively reasonable basis. What a case law says,
exactly.
You may be following someone in a drug investigation, have no basis to stop the person, but when you see the person go through a stop sign, now you have an objectively reasonable basis to do it, and we won't look to your subjective intent, right? Is that not
the
case law?
Exactly what the case law says.
Okay.
On these facts, the detective has told us what his subjective intent is. That aside, he's lawfully pulled Mr. Nelson over. The problem is, we know, the record makes clear, he's never actually investigating those Title 39 violations. The tickets are written at 2:30 a.m., and no one would pretend that Mr. Nelson could be detained that whole time. So what I'm arguing that this court consider is if reasonable suspicion does ripen by minute 38, when he says New York to Philly, that you consider that the traffic mission was over or was abandoned at that point.
Understood.
Because
Understood.
Because if it was, then there's no authority. If I might just say, Chief Justice, in closing, that the state had its chance here and it failed to carry its burden. The state had the burden of demonstrating that the anonymous tip was reliable, and we submit it didn't. The state had the burden of demonstrating that the 75-minute detention of Mr. Nelson was reasonable, and we submit that it didn't. And finally, the appellate division found that the anonymous tip didn't provide reasonable suspicion, and the state failed to cross-petition on that issue. And so for all these reasons, we think suppression should be granted.
Thank you. Ms. Schuster.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court. The appellate division certainly misread Dunbar here, there's no question, and that's not really at issue before the court. The state is not asking for a change in the law. It's never been argued at any point. The state is merely asking that this court affirm the motion judge's well-reasoned opinion, which was based on a finding of reasonable suspicion. That there was a basis to, one, initially ask for consent, and then, two, to request a drug dog. By my count, going through the factors supporting reasonable suspicion, there's 10. The last three are not as strong as the first seven, but I'll go through them quickly. First, there was a detailed, predictive tip that was corroborated prior to the stop. And with respect to that, I do believe that it was the license plate. The record mentions the tag when the officer is cross-examined. He talks about the tag. I don't think there's any basis to believe it's anything other than the license plate based on that testimony, although it appears that a not particularly accurate shorthand, if you want to use the word shorthand for saying registration instead of tag or a plate number. But it was detailed and it was predictive. But we don't stop there because there was a motor vehicle stop. So we look at the detailed tip that provided hard-to-know details, and for the purposes of looking for the reasonable suspicion analysis, we move past the motor vehicle stop because it was lawful, and we take all that we know from the predictive tip, and we look at all the things that corroborated after the stop. And from the moment the officer came up to the car, he noticed the overwhelming odor of air freshener, which corroborates the fact that there was the tip said that there was a large quantity of marijuana, and the officer testified in his training experience that this corroborated that this is used as a masking agent for marijuana, and this also corroborates the tip that it was for a large quantity of marijuana. The number three, the defendant was lying. This is part of what prolongs the stop, likely on the side of the road in the light misting rain, is that he was not being honest with the officers. He gave multiple stories about his itinerary. Number four, not only did he give multiple stories about his itinerary and lie, he couldn't give specific locations about where he was coming from and where he was going. And then number five, he actually confirmed the bookends of the trip that it was New York and Philadelphia, and this further corroborates the tip. And that was a hard-to-know detail. Not just that he was traveling south on this route of that they saw before the stop, with that he was in a place that made sense with the tip, but actually that the bookends. Number six, his excessive nervousness and his sweating profusely, shaking and fumbling. It was so bad, his sweating was so profuse, that the officer testified that he absolutely could tell the difference between the amount of sweating that was happening and the light misting rain. And the officer testified that this wasn't, that he noticed this immediately, that he was excessively nervous and sweating, and that was before he was standing out in the rain for an extended period of time, but he noticed it throughout the encounter. So it was from the outset also. So it wasn't just after an extended period of time. It was directly related to this nervousness in relation to just being pulled over for motor vehicle stops. Number seven, his prior admission that he had been arrested for marijuana. And then the presence in the car of two large duffels, which again were consistent with transporting a large quantity of marijuana. Now certainly someone could use traps under the car to transport it, but the fact that there were two duffels was consistent with the tip, again corroborating the tip. Number nine, there was a single occupant in the car as described by the tip. And number 10, the motor vehicle infractions, whereas alone, obviously, motor vehicle infractions aren't enough. But I think these particular motor vehicle infractions are somewhat telling because it's someone who wants to get where they're going, follows very closely behind the car in front of him in the left lane, and moves to the side, maybe somebody who's trying to get around to get where he's going faster, which would be consistent with you know, trying to get off the road more quickly. It's certainly, again, 8, 9, and 10 are not the strongest factors, but again, these, it's not a divide-and-conquer analysis. It's not take a look at the tip by itself and see if that's good enough. It's going from all the way at the beginning all the way to the end and looking at it in the totality of the circumstances. Reasonable suspicion is even lower standard than probable cause. And probable cause is not even more likely than not. So certainly here, when all of these factors are considered together, there was reasonable suspicion to stop this car. I think one of the things that the appellate division was confused by, it was sort of over-reading this court's opinion in Rosario. And this court, I went back and I took a look at Rosario, and I was trying to figure out what might have made the court a little bit confused. And Rosario's an interesting case. The state in Rosario was not trying to argue that there was reasonable suspicion from the outset based on showing up at this woman's house with a car that was already parked. The state had argued in Rosario that it was just conducting a field inquiry, and this court said no, that based on the conduct of stopping and shining the light in and then immediately demanding credentials, that converted the stop, and then there had to be reasonable suspicion. And there wasn't reasonable suspicion at that point when they demanded credentials. Reasonable suspicion developed from the facts that came after, but of course that's, you can't use those facts later. And so what the police had in Rosario when they pulled up and they shined that light and they went over and demanded credentials was they had a woman who was parked in a lawful parking spot in front of her home. And this court noted that there was no corroborated criminal activity. And of course, if there's corroborated criminal activity, typically one has probable cause. They don't have reasonable suspicion. But I think the point was that there was nothing that the police had done in that case. For instance, the tip in Rosario was that the officer was notified that the person, that the defendant was going back and forth and making deliveries in Jackson. And had the police corroborated that innocent information, but the going back and forth part, that would have then, it would have made the criminal aspects more reliable. Because as this court has recognized, and as the United States Supreme Court has recognized, that an informant who is proved to tell the truth about some things is more likely to tell the truth about other things, including a claim that someone is involved in criminal activity. And so Rosario was not intended to be a repudiation of this court's longstanding Terry jurisprudence and reasonable suspicion jurisprudence. It was an application looking at, so when you look at Rosario in light of all the other, in light of Alabama versus White, in light of Zudik, in Navarrete, the United States Supreme Court made a very clear distinction between Florida versus JL and Alabama versus White, and really was very clear pointing out that it's not that any innocent detail that's corroborated is sufficient. It's that there's a special quality to predictive and hard-to-know details that when they're corroborated, that those can then make it reasonable for officers to believe that the criminal aspects
are corroborated. So let's talk about some of what you consider corroborating, like the motor vehicle violations. I take it you travel on the turnpike from time to time?
From time to time. I try to take side roads.
So
now he's going to call someone with a tip.
Yeah. No. So at 55 miles an hour, you have to be 5 car lengths. Would you not say that a large percentage of the motoring public on the turnpike are following too closely under that standard?
Just because very often people drive dangerously on the turnpike. I honestly wish that police were out there more enforcing the motor vehicles.
My question is, you seem to suggest that drug dealers are the ones whose tires are going over the fog line and following too closely. And I'm asking you, isn't it the fact that a large amount of the motoring public, by the standard given by Officer Detective Kazan, 5 car lengths at 55 miles an hour, a good part of the motoring public, or a good percentage of the motoring public on a turnpike, are following too closely?
I think that's probably a true statement that people...
And it's not a big deal for someone's car wheel to go over fog line.
if someone is following too closely in a light misting rain and the rain has recently started, it's the most dangerous time on the road because of the oil slick. I remember that from.
So, but I'm trying to figure out what that connection is to transporting marijuana. Quite frankly, that's what I'm trying to figure out.
Oh,
because you seem to say that that is one of the corroborative details of a drug transporter.
Well, it's merely one of the totality of all of the circumstances that's there that the officer is allowed to recognize as part of just what happened in this case. And I do think that someone who's trying to get where they're going, I know I tend to follow a little bit more closely than perhaps I should
but
when I'm trying to get
limit.
Where I'm going.
He was under the speed limit.
Well, the car in front of him was, I think he was trying to get around the car. He was in the left lane.
Maybe, but there was no, I mean, obviously.
No, certainly,
somebody's
yeah.
Going 80,
and again, I'm
might.
Not, this case to me is not about the following too closely. The following too closely and the going over the line is, those are Title 39 violations. And those provide an objective, reasonable basis for the stop. I list them only as.
So it doesn't just end there, and that's it.
In fact,
you're following someone too closely on a turnpike, or you're trying to get around them. That goes to the stop, but not further than that, does it?
If this court is happy with the other 9 factors and the totality of the circumstances, it doesn't wish to recognize the motor vehicle violation.
Help us with this. In the brief, there's 8 factors, and here there's 10 that you've articulated for us, and you've identified 3 that are not the strongest. Look at it the opposite way. Tell us what you think are the strongest. Or do you think all 7 that remain are the strongest?
No, I think
not a trick question. I just
yeah.
Want
no,
to try
I
to focus
I think the
that.
Strongest factors are when you take the tip, which the state recognizes should be treated as an anonymous tip for these purposes. When you take the tip,
you can just tick them off. So the tip.
The tip, which is contains hard to know predictive details, that's corroborated even prior to the stop by seeing the car in the route of travel that's described by the tipster.
Take us off the strongest
one.
Position.
And then you have the overwhelming odor of marijuana, of air fresheners,
right.
Which is recognized in the training experience to be a masking agent. You have, and again, that corroborates the tip because of the masking for the marijuana.
Okay.
And then you have the defendant lying, telling multiple stories. Then you have the defendant's inability to give specific locations from where he's coming from and where he's going. And then you have the defendant confirming New York and Philadelphia is the bookends for his trip, which corroborates something that's very hard to know. So not only do you have the predictive that it's going to be traveling on this route, you actually have those destinations. And I do think it is significant, again, with the lying. And an aunt and a cousin and a friend and a cousin, it's not the same. And I think that the excessive nervousness, the excessive sweating from the outset of the stop, that it's not just after a certain amount of time has passed.
So I don't know that we narrowed it down from the 7 that you had left.
Well, from those 7 you wanted even for, I don't know, to me, all of these together, again, these to me are very, they're all powerful
factors. I'll ask it again
and
tell us your response. You said these 3, they're not my strongest. Do you have several that are your strongest, or are you relying, you're uncomfortable doing that?
No, I mean, I think those ones are. The ones that I'm saying are not as strong is...
Which ones are your strongest?
Well, the ones that I just listed, I think, are my strongest.
All 7 are equally strong. Is that what you're saying?
The nervousness, a person stopped on the side of the turnpike surrounded by 3 state troopers, questioned for 37 minutes. You don't think any citizen would be nervous, maybe excessively nervous under those circumstances, and that would be reasonable?
Well, the officer testified that it was from the outset of the stop when he was pulled over from the traffic infractions that he noticed, and that was credited by the judge, that it wasn't at minute 37. And I also want to push back on the time a little bit, just to note that it's perfectly lawful for the police to ask for consent if they have reasonable suspicion for a motor vehicle stop, that they don't have to call for a drug dog immediately. They can ask for consent, and that happened here. So in that period of time between when this defendant was pulled over for his motor vehicle stop, and they're around 35 to 38 minutes later, depending on who's doing the math, perhaps not me, that in that time, you have the defendant telling lies about where he's coming from and where he's going and changing his story. And then you have the officer going and getting, you know, seeking consent. So the time stamp is the refusal for consent, not the period of time. And these were state police. And, I mean, it's not in the record, but typically they call and they get permission to, I mean, if it had been challenged, if the time had been challenged, I believe there would be additional testimony. I mean, they get permission to ask for consent. They pull out the consent form and they go through the full consent form. So the time is, it's not as long, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Is it your position they had to ask for consent before they could have called in a canine unit?
No, it's not my position that they had to, just merely that is one reasonable alternative that mm-hmm. is available to them, and that's what they did here. And drug dogs do take some time to get there, and to the extent that you ask somebody if they want to consent, it gives them the opportunity, if they do, to just have it move very quickly. And if they want to consent and they say there's nothing in there, that they can be on their way. And I think consent, lawful appropriate consent is a perfectly reasonable, in fact, it's often very helpful for motorists to be able to have that opportunity rather than to force them to sit there. And again, this drug dog, when she was called, it was pretty quick for when she was called to when she was on her way. And then came and hit on the car. So nothing about this stop smacks of unreasonableness in any aspect.
Can you respond to Ms. Borden's argument that the mission of the traffic stop was long completed before you got to the 38-minute mark?
Yeah, I think that it's important to note that there can be a dual purpose that's traveling at the same time. The police don't have to, merely because there's an objective reasonable basis to pull the car over, they don't have to ignore that there was a tip. And in this case, when they go to the car and the police immediately notice the smell of marijuana, the tip converts at that point officially from being just a straightforward traffic stop to it's sort of an escalating situation. And the stop, time moves and more facts develop, which is something that's provided for in police. It's been long recognized that police can ask during the mission of a traffic stop, can ask questions. And here, even before they asked a single question, they were confronted with that overwhelming odor of what they recognized to be a masking agent. And they saw that there was multiple air fresheners hanging. So again, that in itself is not enough, but combined with the earlier tip, and then they...
So let's just break it down. One mission is the reason why they stopped it. They said that,
right.
That would have taken not a very long... It wouldn't have taken them 37 minutes to write a following too closely or improper lane change, correct?
Probably not.
So the point is there has to be some other justification other than the reason that they stopped, and that's where you need reasonable suspicion, correct?
Correct. Yeah, and I think that again, came from those you consider what happened before, and that keeps going. And throughout the encounter, there kept being additional corroborating facts that really made a very strong case for reasonable suspicion here. And at the end, that the officer reasonably first asked for consent, and when that consent was denied, reasonably called for a drug dog who came very quickly and then hit on the car. So I think from start to finish that the police had a sort of something else in their minds, that subjectively they were concerned that this car may contain a large quantity of marijuana. That's proper. They received a tip although it was anonymous, from a fellow law enforcement agency.
They needed a reason to stop the car, but once they did it, it was a complete drug investigation, correct?
Well, they also issued motor vehicle summonses.
I understand. They didn't stop it on the basis of the tip. They stopped the car based upon...
On the motor vehicle.
But once they stopped it, it was all about the drug investigation. Is that fair to say?
I think that once they stopped it and the window opened and the overwhelming odor of air fresheners was detected, which the officer knew in his training experience, that then it became a solid drug investigation in addition to...
Oh, you don't think they would have questioned them about the drugs if they didn't smell any air freshener?
I think that they may have, but to the extent that there was nothing else that was going on and the person was honest about where they were going, and there weren't air fresheners, and they knew where they were coming from, and they knew where they were going, and there weren't any warrants, and it was a normal situation, that, you know, that this was a tip and it doesn't pan out, then sometimes, you know, the police do let people go. This notion that because the police could have followed this driver all the way to Philadelphia before stopping them and that they should have done that, I mean, that's ridiculous. The officer testified that they get these tips all the time from ATF, and they get hundreds of these tips, and they don't have the resources to check all of them out. So here they went out, and they happened to observe motor vehicle violations. And so this is perfectly reasonable for them to be able to do that. And simply because someone is believed to be a suspected transporter of narcotics or to be in possession of a large quantity of narcotics that they're transporting, they don't get free motor vehicle violations. There's no rule that says, oh, the police suspect you of doing real drug dealing, and therefore you can commit as many violations as you want to on the New Jersey Turnpike. They don't get a free pass for that. It was absolutely objectively reasonable how the police acted in this case from start to finish.
We don't know who the ATF officer is who called, is that correct?
Yes, that is correct.
We do not?
But even, no, I...
We do not know. Was an effort made to find out who that person was? Do you know how many ATF officers are at this particular office?
I don't know. And honestly, I think under the circumstances, because treating it as an anonymous tip...
I understand. I was just asking if you had answers to those questions.
I don't. I do not have answers to those questions. I do know that there is a concerted effort to work with the feds on... especially for these main corridors in New Jersey, for drug trafficking, the New Jersey Turnpike is one of them, and so there is a concerted effort to try to work together to pass along information.
Detective Kazin testified on cross that he might have listed it in his report, but when he was asked to check it, he said it was not listed, the name of the ATF officer. Does that ring a bell with you?
I know that it was someone had called the Cranberry office and it got transferred to the Newark office. I mean, these aren't, I don't believe that when it came in, I mean, I
we
think.
We don't have it in this record.
I don't think we have it in this record.
Thank you. Ms. Borden? Ms. Hepburn, rather? Brief rebuttal?
No, Your Honor.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement. Court's